Good evening. My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Gosh, so many friends here. This is like a homecoming for me. It's wonderful. I'm delighted to be here. Now, I must explain something to you. All of this equipment that's here, I suppose you've been wondering what the rear projection screen was for. I must explain to you. I've been to a lot of AA meetings. I've heard an awful lot of speakers. But everybody tells their story, you know, but it's all just words. Some tell it with a very brilliant word picture, but still just words. So I thought it would be kind of interesting to have visuals to go along with what I'm doing. Hence the rear projection screen. However, as you know, anything technical, anything can go wrong, will go wrong. And so although I had the infrared signaler to change the slides and to put on where there's motion picture, it got fouled up at the airport and isn't there. So I'm going to go back to the old-fashioned method and use a clicker. So if we can have the first slide, please. Now this, as you see, is part of the photograph from a Gilby gin ad. A very cold, crisp martini and a wonderful Baccarat glass with a twist of lemon. That is the leitmotif of my entire talk. The martini will be appearing from time to time. Next slide, please. Now, this is, you recognize, as the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. I grew up in San Francisco. It's interesting about the Golden Gate Bridge is the people who commit suicide by jumping off of it always jump on the city side, so the last thing they see is the city, which shows that people from San Francisco, even suicidal, have great taste. But this is an honest program, and I must honestly confess to you. I say I grew up in San Francisco. I did. Was not born in San Francisco. I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That requires some explanation. I sprang from the loins of two rather unusual people. My mother and father were both doctors, and my mother was what she called a gynob, a G-Y-N-O-B. And she was almost close to 9 months pregnant. My father was in Tulsa on business. My mother wanted to go see him. And he said, "You can't come to Tulsa from San Francisco. You're pregnant." She said, "I know, but you see, I have this doctor in attendance, so everything is fine." She's a gutsy woman. And so she climbed on a train and pulled into the station in Tulsa and said, "Find me a taxi and point me to the nearest hospital." And so they did, and I was born. Morningside Hospital, here's a picture of it being demolished. Now this, many of you will recognize, it's a picture of Pacific Heights in San Francisco, where I grew up. And this is a picture of the old Fox Theater in San Francisco. Now, there was a time before television, yes, I go back before television, when children went to the Saturday movies, Saturday mornings, Saturday matinees, and they sat through, a bunch of serials. It was like the television shows are now, cartoons and what have you. And I would always go to the Fox Theater because the Fox Theater, unlike a neighborhood theater, had an intermission time. There was organ music. I was enormously fond of the organ music, and so I would sit through two or three or four shows just to hear the organ music. To this day, I am still affected by organs that rise in the dark. This is a picture of the Fox Theater being demolished. I went off to school at the University of Southern California, the only university in the world that has a statue of a Trojan in the front. And halfway through my college career, I decided to enlist in the armed forces. And I became a part of that ideological disparity we refer to as World War II. And I was in the South Pacific flying in airplanes and things, and came back therefrom and continued my education, graduate. Then, as happens quite often in theaters of war, they say there are no atheists in the foxholes, and there are not. I guess man's extremity is God's opportunity. We all identify with that, don't we? And I became very intrigued with the Catholic Church. I was not raised a Catholic. I was raised as kind of a nothing, really. My parents had no feeling about religion whatsoever. And said, you can find out what you want. So I did go around. Whoever went to church, I went with them. But I got intrigued with the Catholic Church. And as is my wont, and many of us share this bill, I don't do anything by halves. I went off to the monastic. And I was at St. Bonaventure's in New York. And San Luis Rey in California. And Santa Barbara in Santa Barbara. The old mission, and then to a place in Huntsville, Utah, a community of the Cistercians of the Strict Observance, normally called Trappists. If you can imagine me taking a vow of silence. I mention that only because it is fascinating. The Trappists are devoted to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and they all of the Trappist priests take the first name of the Blessed Virgin, and then the second name of a saint. So the man could be very well Father Mary Mark, or Father Mary Jerome. My confessor's name was Father Mary Martin. Don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. And you never knew why it broke me up. And he never knew why I had a tendency to sing My Heart Belongs to Daddy. Eventually, I left the monastic by mutual agreement with the Father Abbot and me. He said that I really didn't belong in the monastic. I belonged out in the world. And so I left. And left the conventional life, at least. And ended up in... He told me to go to a place I'd not ever been before. Because he said, start your life anew and decompress. So I did this kind of thing with a map and ended up in Portland, Oregon. Lived there for about 6 years, a wonderful place to live. And and found myself in the world of advertising, simply because somebody suggested I would make a good advertising writer. That makes a great deal of sense, to go into advertising and marketing when you have an advanced degree in medieval Latin and theology. Use it all the time. Now, mind you, I've always drunk. I mean, I've done some drinking. I grew up when if you want to get out your calculators, I grew up when the Volstead Act was still in existence. And that was prohibition. And there was a thing called bathtub gin. At an age of about 10, I knew how to make bathtub gin and a martini, therefrom. And then, of course, in the monastic, there was never any problem with alcohol. So I know some of you use sacramental wine. I never had occasion to do so. But now I move on in my new profession to San Francisco. And I'm happy to say that I am, if I have any claim to fame, is I was one of the founders of the San Francisco Lower Montgomery Street Olive and Onion Society, the Martinis. We got together with regularity and had meetings to determine what was the perfect martini. First, we did a series of tastings to determine the proper balance between vermouth and gin. And we went anywhere from practically no vermouth whatsoever. Started with Old Bartender's Guide, which was two parts gin, one part vermouth. We finally ended up saying that the Italian way was the best. Stir the gin and face Italy. Now then, in San Francisco, drinking is a way of life. Then we had a series of, by the way, we found that 1 to 10 is the perfect, in case that ever comes up, you know. 1 to 10 is the balance between gin and vermouth. We also then had a series of tastings to determine what was the best gin at Booth's House of Lords. What was the best vermouth? It was a Parmesan, dry vermouth. What was the best garnish? And you know, olive, onion, olive stuffed with pimento, olive stuffed with almond, pickled Brussels sprouts. and for the Jewish establishment of old foreskins. Regardless of what your racial persuasion is, you'll be happy to know that the lemon peel won. So, now, drinking was serious. We had a group that got together. We called ourselves the Grant Avenue Improvement Society. And we would meet on Fridays and drink, and then go on to no lunch, forget it, you know. Move on to parties around. And at one point, we'd driven all up to Sausalito. And coming back from Sausalito, I think I was one of the first people, although this is not in history anywhere, who streaked. It wasn't that exactly. I pulled up the bridge on the Sausalito side and decided it would be great to amble, if you will, naked across the Golden Gate Bridge. And so I did. That is, I ambled halfway. A black and white taxi pulled up. And a stunning, muscular gentleman wearing a uniform said, what are you doing? I said, I'm walking across the bridge. You're naked. No. Where are your clothes? My car. Where's your car? It's back at the viewpoint. Why don't you get in our car and let us take you to your car where your clothes are? There were a lot of the kind of goofy things of that sort. I moved from there. The profession that I'm in requires I'm moving to Los Angeles. And I suppose the only things really memorable about Los Angeles, particularly professionally, that is, a lot of drinking going on, was that I was the creative director on the Mattel toy account in advertising, and I made a serious effort to get them to do both Barbie and Ken anatomically correct, and they never would. I then moved on to New York. You recognize the skyline, of course. And was involved with Madison Avenue and creative and cosmetics and fashion and all that sort of thing. You know, I saw the shows and bought the clothes and consumed the gin. No, not true. At this point, I had switched, as all serious drinkers did, from gin to vodka, because everybody knows the juniper berries in gin make you crazy. Now, this ugly statue is called a Clio. I know it looks like something from Dildos or Us, but it's not. It is the award given in advertising. It's the equivalent to the Tony or the Oscar or what have you, and I accumulated a bunch of them in the course of what I was doing. And I generally began at that point to lead the lush life. Remember that wonderful song, that Bart Hart song that Nat King Cole and others have recorded on? Some old, this was I'll rot in some dive, you know, and until I was drinking some dive until I rot with the rest. We're all doing that kind of stuff. 4 or 5 martinis for once were nothing. And I didn't get 4 or 5 martinis and go back to work. I didn't know at the time that people were saying, if you want to talk to Davenport and get any sense out of him, talk to him before lunch. Much later I found that out. But I got to the point that I could go back to work, but then it got so that I had several martinis and I needed a nap. Of all the things in the world that I did not need was to get an offer of a job to move to Sydney, Australia. That, as you recognize, is the opera house. And we had a group that met there again on Friday afternoons. We called ourselves the Poets' Corner, because POETS, which stands for Piss Off Everybody, Tomorrow Saturday. And I worked for a chain of department stores called the David Jones Stores. The David Jones Stores all thought of themselves as the Bloomingdale's of Australia. They were not. They were the B. Altman of Australia. A touch of J.C. Penney, I expect. But I thought it was disenchantment, but a lot of it was not incipient, but practicing, rigorous practicing alcoholism. Australians drink a lot, and I kept up with them. They're good Australian wines, good Australian vodka. And I got an offer to go to work for a small, enterprising, growing company in Kansas City called Hallmark. Well, Hallmark, as many of you know, Crown Center redevelopment is the area where they redid the whole city in that particular part of the town, and I was promotion director for that particular effort. Well, down in the lower level of the shopping center was a bar called 25 Grand. It was on the corner of 25th and Grand, very smart name. They had a happy hour, and you ordered a drink, and Mr. Satu in front of you. That's just the way they did, 2-for-1. And the bartender learned after a while that I would have come in and have 3 rums while I was waiting for traffic to clear. And then plow a furrow 6-axe handles deep down I-35 going home. But he figured out he did this all the time. So he had glasses. Oh, I'm sure you picture this. They were white burgundy glasses. And they looked like a fishbowl with a stem, as you can see. But he figured out one of those held 6 vodka martinis on the rocks. And so I'd walk from the bar, from the entrance to the bar, and there would be that drink sitting. Others would say, "What is that?" And he said, "Well, that's a mad teeny." I have to explain to you, there are no members of the press here, are they taking pictures? My name is Michael Anthony Davenport. My initials are M-A-D. That tells you a lot right there. But that was called a mad teeny. And when they closed the bar, they were redoing the whole Crown Center. The 25 grand was closed, and they gave me a dozen of those glasses in memoriam. Well, at this point, I realized I was not doing my best work, or there was too much work for me to do and still have time to drink as much as I wanted to. So I said, "I'm going to freelance." That means work at home. I dignified that by saying, "Well, after all, the President of the United States does it. Why shouldn't I?" So that was great. I could stay home and drink and take an occasional job whenever it was required, just enough to make some money to buy more booze. And so this was in 1978. There was a blizzard that year. And I had every reason in the world to pull the draperies and didn't bother showering as much as I used to. I didn't bother shaving as much as I used to. I went out for more cigarettes and more vodka. And I was at this point a half gallon of vodka a day, maintenance. Not counting the rare occasions when I went out and did drink. One night will be forever engraved in my memory because it was near the bottom of my existence. It was late at night. It was about 10 maybe. The liquor stores closed at 10:30. Those of you who know Berbelia. I was about out of cigarettes. The vodka was down like that. I might just run out during the night, you know, and I couldn't wait until the next day. There was a blizzard going on outside. Well, there was a blizzard to stop it. It was heavy snow and cold. I didn't have any ski clothes. I gave up skiing a number of years ago. My front teeth got too long. So I started rummaging for clothing, and in the bottom of a drawer, I found a pair of black leotards. No, it was not left over from an all-night visitor. Sometime I thought I was going to take a modern dance class, and so I had. But those are the nearest things I can find to long johns. So I put them on, and I put pajamas. Everybody keeps pajamas around in case you have to go to the hospital. That's the only reason you have them. I put the pajamas on, and the pants, and then several layers of sweaters, and a coat, and put a cap on, and then tied a muffler around under my chin so I looked terribly much like Katharine Hepburn. And went rushing off to Berbelia's into the snowstorm. As I was coming back, I was 2 blocks away. As I was coming back, there were piles of snow where the snow plows had come along. And I walked a block, and I was weak. I needed a drink. So I sat down the snowbank and upended the half gallon vodka jug. And there was an incline there. And cars were coming down the incline. In the snow, it's silent. There's no sound. You hear the of tires. And the car applied the brakes and fishtailed ever so slightly. So I sat there and watched that and drank for my half gallon of vodka. Began to think, what if a car comes down that hill and they hit their brakes too hard and they spin out of control and they hit me and I'm taken to the hospital and I have on black leotards? Second ball. Years later, when I was moving, and after I had recovered, I found the leotards in the bottom of the trunk, so I had them framed. Happy remembrances of my past. At one point during that winter, I had taken a friend to, there's a hospital in the outskirts of Kansas City, Shawnee Mission Hospital, And they had, at that time, a very good one. I think the only one, really, in Kansas City, that alcoholism recovery unit. So I'd taken a friend there, and so I knew about it. So somewhere along about the middle of April, toward the middle of April, I'd been holed in, mind you, not being too careful about personal hygiene, and drinking and pass out, and drink and pass out, and drink and pass out. And one night something clicked. I know now what it was. And I thought, there has got to be a better way. There's something wrong. I remembered the name of the attending physician of my friend. And I called him. I said, you don't know me. My name is, etc. I need help. He said, can you get to Shawnee Mission? I said, of course. And he said, well, I'll call admitting and tell them you're coming. And so, after all this, you know, carelessness of living, I got myself gussied up, properly pomaded and pomaded and cologned, in a gray Pierre Cardin suit, suitably accessorized, and took a 20-minute taxi, $20 taxi drive to Shawnee Mission. And they said, at that time, the alcoholism unit was in an outbuilding, not an outhouse, but it was a building away from the main one. And there was a tunnel that went under, and they said, at a moment, somebody will come by and take you out to the ward. And I said, well, that's not necessary. I've been here before. I escorted a friend here. And so I grandly set off in this tunnel. Like many hospitals, there were, you know, a red line that said this is the way to x-ray, and a green line that said this is the way to, you know, the directions are pointed on the floors, on the walls. And I remember walking down this tunnel, and there was like something from a Hitchcock picture. The lines began to twist like angry snakes. And I passed out. And I rarely had ever passed out while drinking. But this time I did, and awakened to somewhat startling discovery. I was in intensive care and had been in intensive care for 5 days. I had acute alcoholic neuritis. I was paralyzed from the inoperative, from the waist down. The doctor had given instructions to the hospital staff, said if he comes to and makes enough sense to sign a paper, a release form, I want to take that body to pathology because I want the students to see that liver. It's got to be a classic. And they set up a death watch for me. I hardly tell you I did not die. Here I am. I went through, after I got out of intensive and I was in hospital care, and then on to the ward. It was a good one, very, very good program. It was AA oriented. And so a couple times a week, people were asked from the area to come and bring a meeting, you know, to the hospital. That's not unusual for any of us. Well, for those of you who don't know that area, it's sort of in the general area of an area called Raytown. Now, I must tell you, Raytown is the Velveeta capital of the world. Part of the requirements for living in Raytown are a pickup truck, a pit bull, a 12-pack in the back, you know, a flannel shirt with the underwear showing, either a hard hat, a red neck, a blue shirt, or white socks, or Prince Builder shoes. I mean, that's the standard cousin. So this bunch brought the AA meeting to the hospital. That was bad enough. I thought, if this is AA, and I knew nothing about AA, I used to laugh about it. I'd say, I'm an alcoholic. I should have a med alert saying, I'm an alcoholic in case of emergency, give me a martini. But I thought, if to be a member of AA, I have to be that kind of a good old boy. Thank you very much. I'm not awfully enthusiastic about this. And one night, one of the good old boys arrived replete with guitar and told his story in song. Badly. I'm not talking Willie Nelson. Well, I led a revolt. And even that early on in my recovery, I wanted to change things. And they did. So I was encouraged to go to AA meetings afterward. I wanted to have no part of it. I kept going back to the hospital for aftercare. And eventually moved on to go to a meeting in Kansas City. Many of you may go to the Plaza Fellowship. It's the second oldest fellowship in Kansas City. It's been in existence. We just recently celebrated 40 years of this particular unit. It's a Friday night speaker meeting. It's a good group, good bunch of folk. A little geriatric, but then I belonged. And The meeting room has crystal chandeliers and upholstered furniture and carpeted, and there's a platform, and when the speaker speaks, the house lights dim, and there are two pink spotlights. That's just nifty. That's my kind of AA, folks. And several of us that attended the meeting with some, there's about 100 or so people attend every Friday, and it's considered an honor because it is a prestigious group to be asked to speak at the Plaza Fellowship. There are several of us that were attending there, and we were looking at each other with slightly askewed eyebrows. And back of the head, the back of the eyes were going, "Are you?" And so one night we were having coffee, we decided, yes, we are. And there is no gay AA group in Kansas City. And so in 1979, we started one, which has become Live and Let Live, which many of you know, with 21 meetings or so a week, and we're about to do our 11th roundup this coming year. You're all welcome. Please come. By the way, somebody asked me earlier today, I don't normally think about it, but somebody asked me, and I said with great pride, in April I will celebrate 14 years of sobriety. Thank you very much. Couldn't have done it without you. Now then, I'm glad that the theme is the program We've Got to Live It, because I've been living it rather intensely upon occasions, rather gaily in on other occasions. Read that word any way you want. But there, I want to point out to you some myths of AA that I have discovered that delight me. So now we're going to go to on the screen, myths of AA. If you want to put on your glasses, that'll help, okay? First myth. We do not take others' inventory. We are just helping you with your program in your absence. Myth number two, we do not give advice. Myth number three, these are but suggested steps. There suggest. I might suggest, do not put razor blades instead of croutons in your salad. Do not dance Swan Lake in the middle of I-35 at rush hour. Come on, noble friends, we're not talking about whether or not to wear white pants after Labor Day. This is a matter of life and death. Suggested steps. Myth number four. You do the 12 steps and you graduate. Anybody care to show me their wallet size diploma that they got? The Army, we say there are 12 steps in the AA program. The Army says there are 4 steps. Hip, 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 four. But you keep taking them over and over and over, and you can take quite a long journey carrying quite a heavy burden and arrive well and healthy and happy. Okay. Myth number five. My life is now manageable. I don't know about any of you. It just becomes more and more unmanageable as time goes by. But somehow I managed to keep it all organized. Chaos. I just learned to live with the fact that if there's one thing I can't stand, it's one thing after another, and there it is, and there's nothing I can do about it. Along with this myth would be, I'm restored to sanity. Yeah. I never knew what sanity was until I got into the frame. I lived an insane life. It was insane by a lot of standards other than just simply the consumption of alcohol. And I remind you go to a flea market or an auction, you see this wonderful table, probably Heppel-White, Chippendale, fine lines. I'll buy it for $25 and I'll take it home and restore it. So I take it home and I take off that layer of ugly pink enamel, that layer of ugly green enamel, the bottom of it in fine old first edition Formica. I've never been restored to sanity. There's no restoration involved here at all. Next myth. God can be anything. A doorknob, a ficus tree, quiche, industrial carpeting and track lighting. I don't think I'd like to think of any of those things as a higher power at all. Higher power is exactly what the word says. It is a higher power. It is a power that I have, like anything, any other form of power. If the volume is too low, turn up the volume for higher power. If the illumination is inadequate, spiritual or otherwise, turn up the rheostat for higher power. Now, I'm just telling you that my name for my higher power is Spook. Spook is a nickname for Holy Spirit, Holy Ghost. Because my idea of a deity is half poltergeist and half deity. And that suits me just fine, you know. Spook is always there, never visible, but does great and wonderful things for me. I spoke at a roundup in Memphis several years ago, and I said, something about Spook. Afterwards, one of the kindly gentlemen said, Mr. Davenport, that was a mighty fine talk, but I think I'll tell you that down here, Spook means something else. But I don't mind. It makes no difference to me. You know, a spook doesn't have any color. It's not so. But I need a higher power. I don't want the idea of deifying a ficus tree. Somehow it doesn't do anything to contribute to my sobriety. Okay, another. This isn't exactly a myth, but it's a quote. Well, what do you expect from a drunk? My gorge rises when I hear that. And, I'm sure I once was a drunk, and I can laughingly say myself, I'm a drunk. As I can laughingly say, with some accuracy, I'm an aged faggot. But I'm not just a drunk, I'm a recovering. I'm learning how to live the program. You have to live it, and I'm doing it. I'm improving, I'm getting better and better and better. The alcoholics, I think an awful lot, you know, what do you expect of a drunk, you know? I'm no good. And then you combine a confused sexual orientation on top of that, you know. I'm no good, I'm a drunk, I'm also queer into the bargain. Well, come on. You know, we all belong to a whole bunch of minorities. The thing about this, I belong to several. Let's see, I'm Irish. CIA. Catholic Irish drunk. I'm in San Francisco, the Irish is a minority. They're pig in the parlor Irish and lace curtain Irish. You know? And I am an intellectual, whatever that means, and always have been. And I am, and that gives me one more kind of minority to work out. I also am a middle-aged, whatever that means, drunken faggot. That's fine. The only minorities I haven't covered are Hispanic and Hispanic and female. And give me some ruffles in the castanet and I'll take care of that. But part of living as a recovering, there are a lot of wonderful discoveries. Now, these are only, I discovered them. I'm sure that, you know, if I walked up to Mount McKinley and said, aha, I've discovered Mount McKinley. I said, no, people discovered it before that. But I discovered and am told and guided by all my fellow recoverings to discoveries about AA that are enormously comforting to me. Changes is the first thing that comes to mind, because I've changed so much and so many times in so many ways, as we all have. Any of you that I've known for over the course of more than 20 minutes, really, I look and see faces of people I've known for a long time and dearly love, and we all have changed. Now, it's surprising that that is the nature of it. The nature of the serenity prayer is, accept the things I cannot change. Change the things I can. All I can change is what goes on inside of me. My attitude, my outlook, my manner of doing and thinking. And so that's what we're really all about. We get together to change for the better. Most changes are for the better, as long as we stay sober and chemical free. But boy, as AAers, do we resist change. Say the serenity prayer at the end of the meeting instead of the front, and three people will be up in arms. You know, they say, how many alcoholics does it take to change a light bulb? 5. 1 to change the bulb, and 4 to complain about how nice the old bulb was. And those who have said that, you know, insanity is doing the same things over and over and expecting different results. It doesn't work that way. The aspect of change is what is exciting to me about living the program of AA. You know, there's a wonderful line from Beckett. It says, try again, fail again, fail better. And I do. There are no mistakes in the world. And if there are really mistakes, so what? Pencils have erasers. There are no mistakes. There are only retakes. It didn't work right. I would do it some other way. A mistake is evidence of my free will. I play some keyboards, not well, enough to amaze myself. But that's how I learned, by making mistakes. That's how we learn anything, by making mistakes. And so the mistakeability in the program, the opportunity and the chance to grow. In inventory, I take a lot of them. I take little mini inventories, of course, to do the 10th step through all of its variations. And all these do is indicate, A, where I have changed, and B, leads me to the next change. Now, it sounds as if I had it down so pat and so cool and so under control. Yeah, my life is manageable, right? There are times when I feel like one of those Dan Garfield dolls in the back of a car, hanging onto the universe with suction cups. But not always, you know. Life is not a game in sobriety. Life is not a game of Dungeons and Dragons. You know, there are times when I feel like the log lady in Twin Peaks. You know. But I have changed. I have changed a lot. There are vestiges of drunken behavior here and now, but a lot of them are gone. I don't find myself walking into the supermarket and say, I want to buy everybody in here a loaf of bread. So I'm getting better. And sometime along the course of the last few years, I stopped kicking the tires of the program and getting really involved with it and buying into it. Time, the aspect of time, is the thing that's the most remarkable for me in this everyday effort of living the program. And time is wonderful because it keeps everything from happening at once. And time is a thing that's in the flow. For several years, not so far past, Unity out of Kansas City used to do a series of one-minute television spots called The Word from Unity. And they had the celebrities who, and the word was so-and-so, whatever it was. The word was ideal, the word was faith, and they made them words. One of them was Pearl Bailey God Lover, and her word was prayer. And she said, now they made a whole bunch of words for me to say, and I just can't say them. I just want to talk to you. Now, listen to Pearlie Mae. When you pray, you may think your prayers aren't being answered. But, honey, I got to tell you, you can pray all you want to, and God's got a different wristwatch than you've got. And he does. And there's a thing called divine delay that makes... keeps me from making some terrible mistakes from time to time. As for the practice of the program, every time I hear this line, we thought we could find an easier, softer way. I think, I don't want an easier, softer way. No, I don't want that. Like the old lady sitting on the front porch and rocking, saying, God sends me tribulations, I tribulate. But it isn't that. I'm reminded of the astronaut who was interviewed, and he said, you know, it gave me some pause traveling around in outer space and realizing that every piece of that equipment that was supporting my life had been awarded to the lowest bidder. Yeah. I deserve the best, and I don't want an easier, softer way. I want a program that has to stretch me, and it does. It does. And as soon as I think I've been stretched as much as I can, here comes another opportunity to be stretched. You see, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a product. I used to think it was exclusively for me. It's not. It's a product. But you see, I'm the consumer of this product. It's called sobriety. It's called step program. AA is the distributor of this program. God is the manufacturer, and the promises are the manufacturer's guarantee. And if it isn't working, I can turn in my program and try another. Ha, ha. You know, so many years when I was first in the program, I was content simply to not drink. I was happy, more than content. The chaos of the line from the big book, come out from the cellar and say, oh, isn't it nice? The wind stopped blowing after a cyclone. But there's still this debris that has to be cleared up. But there's no plea bargaining for me about sobriety and living a sober and productive life. That's what it's all about. But it isn't a magic thing that God does. He lets me do it and helps me. One of my favorite gurus, who dates back to about the 14th century, yes, I was there. St. Teresa of Avila says, my life is in God's hands, and these are the only hands that God has got. Well, living the program today is a fascinating exercise of the three givings. Giving, forgiving, and thanksgiving. Now I have to give, not only to others, but to myself. I have to forgive, or give for, to others, and to myself. And thanksgiving is exactly what it is, giving thanks. I'm not talking about turkeys and pumpkins, but giving thanks is what it is. I don't like the word gratitude. The reason I don't like it, there are a lot of words in AA that I call library words that are engraved on libraries, you know, truth, justice, the common wheel, all the... Gratitude is one of those words. And you hold a meeting and say, you know, the subject of the meeting today is gratitude, and everybody starts making up lies. Those heavy words, but thanksgiving, giving thanks, I can understand. See, AA gave me my life, continues to give me my life, and I want to give AA a wonderful life. If you're relatively new in the program, I want you to know it's safe here. It's a safe place to be. And the winds can blow, and the lightning can strike, but AA is safe. And as I live today, I was thinking about it coming in the day before yesterday. We had a delay at the airport before we could take off. And I thought, isn't it wondrous? My life is like an airport runway, with great adventures lined up, ready to take off. And all I need is clearance to be launched on another wonderful adventure in sobriety. This is part of that as being here, this here and now. I look at my watch, it not only tells me the time is moving, but it's also now by my wristwatch. And as good a time as ever to say the last slide. The old leotards. Picture of an AA meeting brings like this. The martini. Souvenir coffee cup. There have been a few changes. And so we've run out of slides. I have run out of time, except for my gratitude. I'm very grateful to all of you. Thank you very much for asking me to be here. Thank you for being here.